WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Ruth Reichel knows a lot about food, how to prepare it, how to savor it, and how to write about it. She's the former restaurant critic for the New York Times and the LA Times, and she's been editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine since 1999. She's just written her third gastronomic memoir, Garlic and Sapphires, about what it's like to have maybe the best job in the world. Many restaurant critics disguise themselves when they're dining out, but Reichel went so far as to create alter egos with their own names, personalities, and elaborate get-ups. Terry Gross spoke with Reichel last October.
Now, before going to Gourmet, you were restaurant critic for the New York Times, and one of the things that you were famous for was wearing disguises, using aliases on your credit cards so that people wouldn't know who you were and that you wouldn't be given special treatment and specially prepared food, special tables, and therefore you could assess what the restaurant was really like, not what it was like when they were trying to please you because you were the restaurant critic for the Times. So how is the dining out experience different for you now? You are still in the food writing business, you're just not reviewing restaurants for the Times. So are you still using any kind of disguises or phony names?
No, the disguises are over. And it's very different now. I mean, I go out and most of the time use my own name. And I sort of figure after 30 years of, you know, being the people's spy, being completely anonymous, always getting the worst table in the room, it's really nice to go out and get a good table, not have to wait for my table. Although I have to say that my husband, who really does not like all the falderal, really prefers it if we just go anonymously. So I would say about half the time, we still make them in somebody else, whoever's name we're going with, and just, you know, try and be ordinary people.
When you were using disguises, wigs, I guess funny glasses probably too.
Well, you know, I have a book coming out in April.
Which you're going to talk about that?
Uh-huh. About the disguises. I mean, it's literally each chapter is in the voice of another disguise. I mean, I had real people who I became, and the disguises were very elaborate, and it was an amazing experience to feel what it was like to be an old lady. My probably most effective disguise was as a sort of very nondescript old woman who was never treated very well. And then I also had I thought she was pretty sexy anyway, blonde woman. And that for someone who I am not blonde or sexy. And it was amazing to discover my inner blonde with Chloe.
And Chloe, it was, perfect.
Yes.
What was the older woman called?
Mrs. The older woman was Betty Jones.
Oh, Betty
and
Jones,
she was
okay.
Known, and she went out with groups of people, and she was known as Aunt Betty. And everybody referred to her as Aunt Betty. And Aunt Betty had, you know, really, I found her on a bus. I saw a woman, I got up once on a bus to give my seat to an older woman. And she looked at me and she said, "Are you really giving me your seat?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Oh, no one ever stands up for me. Sometimes I feel invisible." And I thought, that's what I want. I want to be invisible. So I actually followed her home and her name, you know, looked at her name on her mailbox, and she was Betty Jones. And I turned myself into Betty Jones, and it was an amazing experience.
Where did you go shopping to be her?
I went to thrift stores, and I actually found a pair of Energetic shoes. Do you remember Energetics? They were those sort of lace-up Oxfords with the little holes in them, and I found a pair that fit me perfectly, and I would wear layers and layers of clothes, so I got much larger without having to have pillows on under me. And she really, nobody saw her.
But I'll
say nobody saw her.
You can't be, you know, Aunt Betty and go to Le Cirque, because Aunt Betty isn't going to be able to afford Le Cirque. She's unlikely to be there. So you were probably only able to be her in certain restaurants that you were reviewing.
Right, but I could be Aunt Betty in a group of people at Le Cirque, where I could take other people
And you'd be their
disappear.
Aunt Betty.
I'd be their Aunt Betty, and I might not be appropriate there, but you get lost in a crowd, and she would just disappear. So we would all be anonymous, and I would get to see what happened. But certainly, Aunt Betty alone in a restaurant was pretty conspicuous.
I confess, there are certain things that really bug me about certain restaurants that I see as really pretentious. But I'm wondering, when you were in the guise of Aunt Betty, if there were certain aspects of the more high-end restaurants that seemed particularly snobbish or pretentious to you.
The most difficult experience I had in a restaurant as Aunt Betty was I went by myself once alone to a pretty fancy restaurant as Aunt Betty just for lunch to check on something. I was writing the review and I suddenly realized that I had only had this dish once and I thought, to be fair, I needed to have it a second time. So I became Aunt Betty, went there for lunch, and the maitre d' was very nice, but it was the response of these rich women in the restaurant not wanting to sit near me that really offended me. the maitre d' started bringing this bejeweled woman, and she sort of glanced at me and said, I'd like another seat. And I found that deeply offensive. I mean, much more offensive than anything any restaurant ever did.
Do you like coffee shops? And I'm talking about, there's a certain type of New York coffee shop where it's not, like, the coffee's probably really terrible there, but they have, you know, they have your basic, like, omelets and chicken and fish dishes that are prepared, nothing special, but they're really cheap, they're perfectly serviceable, they're fast. I mean, I just love places like that.
And not only that, if you go there a few times, they know you, and you walk in, you sit down at the counter, and they instantly know that what you want is a corn muffin toasted and a cup of coffee with no sugar in it.
Exactly.
And it just, it slides in front. What I love about those places is I love the daily ritual of it. I love that becoming part of a community. I mean, for me, that's one of the things that's so great about restaurants, is that it is a way for you to have a life outside of your ordinary life where you are known, but you're known in just that small corner. And it's very comforting to go in on a regular basis and have that sort of 3 or 4 time a week conversation with someone and to feel like you're recognized. And, you know, I mean, for people like the Betty Joneses of the world who live alone, it's something really wonderful that kind of restaurant, it's a purpose that it serves.
Well, you know, when you were Betty Jones, you would sometimes go alone to a restaurant. I don't know if you do that in your other disguises as well, or if you do that as yourself, as Ruth Reichel. How do you feel about dining alone in a restaurant? Some people are very comfortable doing that. Some people feel incredibly self-conscious. For some people, it makes them feel incredibly lonely, and they think that other people will be staring at them, feeling sorry for them.
Well, I did it. I almost always went to the restaurants that I was reviewing at least once alone, because I like to eavesdrop on people, and it's very hard to do that when you're with a group of people. So I would always go alone just to sort of try and soak up the atmosphere of the restaurant and just to sit there and, you know, focus on what people around me were saying and what they were doing. I have to say that I'm not self-conscious about it, but for me, eating is a social act, and it's not a great pleasure to me to eat alone. You know, I would do it for work, but given my druthers, I would really rather eat bad food in a congenial group of people than great food by myself.
So you're not the kind of person who'll go and prop up your newspaper on the ketchup bottle and enjoy dining out alone.
No, I mean, I, you know, as I said, it's a great way to sort of soak up the
atmosphere. I've done that a lot. But,
no, I'm more likely to go home and eat a bowl of cereal if I'm by myself.
Right.
I mean, I love the social interaction of eating. And for me, you know, the great joy of cooking, of preparing a meal, is that you're gathering people you care about, interesting people, around a table, and you're facilitating the conversation. You know, one of the things that good food does in a relaxed atmosphere is it just makes what happens at a table that much more pleasurable and that much more interesting. And, you know, for me, that's what cooking is about.
You want to tell us about another one of your New York Times reviewer characters?
Sure. Well, my favorite was Brenda. Brenda was a big, boisterous redhead, very messy red hair, long, slightly bohemian, and she made people smile. Everybody smiled at her. And I just felt like Brenda's world was a nicer place than my world. Just everybody talked to her. Waiters loved her, brought her extra food. Even in very fancy restaurants, one of my great experiences was going with a group of friends as Brenda and having this quite starchy woman at the next table lean over and say, you know, it looks to me like you don't come to restaurants like this very often. And then getting incredibly embarrassed because she'd realized what she'd said. And Brenda said, no, thank you. That's true. We don't. And she said, well, I just want to make sure you don't miss the great food at this restaurant and be sure that you order this and this and this. And, you know, Brenda was a great pleasure. And, you know, so much so that it scared me a little. My family liked her better than they liked me.
Were you ever in theater?
No, but this was, when I started doing the disguises, my mother had a friend who was a theatrical coach, and she helped me. With the first disguise, she said, you really need to, you need to inhabit this. You can't just put on a wig. That's not going to work. If you're going to do this right. You're the restaurant critic of the New York Times, and you can't be a fool. So she made me, for my first review, which was the review of Le Cirque, she made me really do the whole backstory for the person that I was becoming, who was a very middle-aged Midwestern, very unexceptional woman. But she made me know everything about her. And she came with me to the first meal, and I really did find myself becoming that person. It was a little spooky, but very fun.
Did you have voices for them?
I did. It wasn't conscious. And I can't do them unless I'm them. You know, I mean, it's just now I can't do them. And I'm a little worried because I'm going to have to read the book. And I'm afraid that I'm going to have to get in. And I don't have the disguises anymore because when I left the Times, we auctioned them off for charity. And I don't have them anymore, and I don't know how I'm going to do the voices.
Ruth Reichel speaking to Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with author and food critic Ruth Reichel. Her newest book, Garlic and Sapphires, has just been published.
Ruth, the last time we spoke was when your memoir, Tender at the Bone, was published. And in that, you wrote a little bit about your mother, who you described as being food blind in the way that some people are colorblind, and
right.
that she would like serve food that had turned bad and wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And I was trying to remember, was your mother mentally ill? Was this a symptom of a larger problem?
Yeah, she had what's now called bipolar disorder, which in those days was called manic depression. And we didn't know it for a long time. And then in the beginning of the 60s, when the first people who were working with, you know, psychopharmacology, my mother went to see one of those doctors. And for her, it was just a huge relief to know that it wasn't her fault. You know, she'd been in analysis, and it was all about, this is your fault. And, you know, she said that, you know, being told that there were drugs that you could take for it was just, you know, just a huge relief. In the book, I initially tried to make her a comic character. And when it didn't work, I sort of just came clean and said, you know, she did have this illness.
Were there different foods that she'd make depending on whether she was in a manic or depressive period?
Well, when she was depressed, she just went to bed. She'd go to bed for months on end and literally read the same book over and over and over again. And I mean, one of the reasons, and I didn't put this into the book, but one of the reasons that I started cooking so early was that Mom would just, you know, you'd come home from school and she would not have gotten out of bed all day. And so the cooking really did fall to me. I didn't think that was something that you put in the book. But when she was manic, she was really when she did. I mean, I describe in the beginning of that book, I describe a party she gave for my brother's engagement when she put 26 people in the hospital with food poisoning. And that was at her absolute most manic. When, you know, she went to Horn and Hardart and came home with a car filled with little tiny boxes of food that they had been selling as seconds and mixed it all together in this disgusting mush. And that was, you know, that was about as manic as you can get.
Are there foods that you developed a revulsion to because of something that your mother served, not realizing that it had gone bad or that it just simply tasted terrible?
Oddly, no. You know, what my mother's illness did for me was make me very acutely aware of food, make me very conscious of tasting it to see, is this good or is this not good, really honed my taste buds. I mean, I think made me really focus on flavor and describing it to myself. I think made me into a food writer. And for whatever reasons, because I'm genetically predisposed to love food and love cooking and love eating or whatever, there's almost nothing that I don't like. And even some of the foods that my mother made most miserable, I still love.
You have a son who I believe is about 14. Is that right?
He's 15, yes.
Okay. How has being a mother changed you as a cook? Because, let's face it, children's tastes and adults' tastes and foods are pretty different. And so you had to learn to cook for a child in addition to cooking for you and your husband.
I have to say the one thing that I feel as a mother is the most important thing, and it's why I ultimately stopped being a restaurant critic and took a job where I could be home cooking dinner every night, is that I think the most important thing you can do for your children is sit down to dinner together. We have breakfast and dinner every day with my family, and I don't think it matters what you put on the table or how you get that food on the table. I don't think it matters whether you cook it yourself or you order in, but I do think it's important to sit down and eat dinner with your children. And so I have tried to cook foods that Nick will like, but I think the notion that children have different tastes is sort of silly. You know, children in Vietnam eat different foods than children in France and children in the United States, and children eat what they are given. They aren't born with tastes. And I've never forced Nick to eat anything. You know, we'll cook things that he likes, but he started out as a kid who ate five white foods. And as a 15-year-old, he's an omnivore. He will eat anything. And I think it's partly because he just saw that we loved food.
Ruth Reichel, thank you so much for talking with us.
This has been a pleasure.
Ruth Reichel, speaking to Terry Gross. Her new book, Garlic and Sapphires, is subtitled The Secret Life of a Critic in Disguise. She's the editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine and has worked as a restaurant critic on both coasts for the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times.